Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our first occasional lecture for 2013. It's wonderful to see so many people here today, and I'm sure you're going to bless yourselves for coming out today to hear today's lecture, because we have an old friend returning to us, Dr. David Heaton. We've experienced his lectures before on many topics, or several topics, but today, of course, we're launching these, well, we're not, but it's the centenary of Canberra year, and we thought that we would launch our 2013 series with a lecture that commemorated the centenary of Canberra. Now, David is cultural and heritage advisor to the Centenary of Canberra committee in the Chief Minister's Department, and as we all know, we've seen him doing lots of work on radio and television, digging up the fascinating stories behind the story of the National Capital. And today, if you liked the lecture, you can then go on to look at the exhibition, because this is the lecture of the exhibition. The exhibition, you ask? Well, if you stay on this floor and go over to the other side of the building near the post office, you will see where the exhibition is currently located. And it has a range of treasures, lots of them with fascinating stories behind them. And to talk to us today about some of those stories, under the formal title, But Once in a History, Canberra's Foundation Stones and Naming Ceremonies, 12th of March, 1913. Would you please welcome Dr. David Heaton?
Thanks very much, Rosemary. Ladies and gentlemen, before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet, past and present. When King O'Malley, the legendary King O'Malley, penned the introduction to a book he had commissioned in later 1913, he searched for just the right sequence of characteristically lofty, even visionary phrases. After all, as the Minister for Home Affairs in the Progressive Labor Government of Prime Minister Andrew Fisher, he had responsibility for establishing the new Australian nation's capital city. Vigorous promotion of the idea he knew was essential. So at the beginning of a book entitled Canberra, Capital City of the Commonwealth of Australia, telling the story of the milestone foundation stones and naming ceremonies that took place in Canberra on the 12th of March 1913, O'Malley declared for posterity that such an opportunity as this, the Commonwealth selecting a site for its national city in almost virgin country, comes to few nations and comes but once in a history. This grand foundation narrative of Canberra, with its abundance of aspiration, ambition, high-mindedness, courage, and curiosities, is still not well enough known today. The city did not begin as a compromise between a feuding Sydney and Melbourne, they wish. Its roots comprise a far, far better yarn than that. Unlike many major cities of the world, it was not created because of war, because of revolution, disease, natural disaster, or even to establish a convict settlement. Rather, a nation lucky enough to be looking for a capital city at the beginning of a new century knuckled down to the task with creativity and diligence. The Federation founders knew they had been blessed. Globally, the science of town planning, as it was first called, had only recently emerged, and those directly involved in the construction of the Australian capital wanted to take full advantage of the most sophisticated design and planning expertise on offer from any source. It was a unique opportunity. Discussion soon focused on a city shaped organically, within the landscape, not one plonked down, in the words of the first member for Eden Monaro, Sir Austin Chapman, plonked down like a tent. Federation Australians wanted their future capital to be, as William Astley, an opium-addicted journalist, an immensely skilled short story writer, Price Warren was the pseudonym, of the time so memorably described it, the treasure house of a nation's heart. Only in this context can we make sense of the major moments in Canberra's early history, from Federation in 1901 to the beginning of the Great War in 1914. The absorbing, if eccentric, Battle of the Sites from 1902 to 1908 to find a capital location. The erection of first Commonwealth infrastructure on the plains, hills and mountains of the Monero. The exhausting five-year survey of the Federal Capital Territory borders that took its protagonists deep and dangerously into the Southern Alps. And the extraordinary international design competition for the Federal Capital City of the Commonwealth of Australia, won by an inspired husband and wife design team from Chicago who, in Walter's resonant words, planned a city not like any other city in the world, an ideal city. A city that meets my ideal, said Walter, of the city of the future. Walter and Marion Griffin produced by far the most expansive dream in an era given to such imaginings. Not surprisingly, when Prime Minister Andrew Fisher and the Governor-General, Lord Thomas Denman, delivered their speeches in the luncheon tent on Kurrajong, more or less Capitol Hill, a century ago, they responded not only to the historic significance of the occasion, but also to the prevailing set of cultural, political and social circumstances. Fisher anticipated a city where the best thoughts of Australia would be expressed, as he put it, a seat of learning as well as of politics and the home of art. A Robin Archer special. The Governor-General went one better, envisaging a city that reflected all that is finest and noblest in the national life of the country, a city bearing, perhaps, some resemblance to the city beautiful of our dreams. In today's lecture, as with the exhibition Rosemary alluded to that I've curated, currently on display in the Presiding Officer's Gallery, not too far from here, in this beautiful Aldo Jurgler building, I'll focus attention on six aspects of what was 100 years ago a great day out on the 12th of March 1913 for all who participated, for all who were there. First, the build-up, the days and weeks immediately preceding 12th of March, as it began to dawn on a panicking media in Victoria that their marvellous Melbourne might soon be replaced by some remote, woebegone bush location in arch-rival New South Wales. Secondly, the sheer pageantry of the morning activities and the formal ceremonies of the big day, as hundreds of mounted horsemen and other units supplied splashes of wild colour and an immensely satisfying display of military pomp and military gravitas. Thirdly, I'll provide a brief overview, I hope, of not one, but the three ceremonies on the 12th of March that made it such a distinctive, nationally significant set of events. Fourth, I'll say a few things about the formidable cluster of individuals gathered on the deep crimson mat atop the newly laid foundation stones on that sunny autumn day on the limestone plains of the Monero. Next, I'll explore Raymond Longford's beautiful film footage of the day's activities, the 19 minutes of film which somehow has miraculously survived, when some 85%, I think the figure is 87%, of our silent film history has not survived. And finally, I'll touch on the notable absentees of the day, if time permits, individuals who we might reasonably have expected to be VIPs, but who were in fact no-shows for a variety of reasons. Reasons ranging from dementia to the demands of other. I would have smiled, except as you'll hear, and it alludes to Alfred Deakin, and there's something desperately sad about that story that I can't really go into, but nevertheless, dementia it was, to the demands of other important posts, to straight departmental stupidity and ignorance. In the days leading up to Wednesday, the 12th of March 1913, Canberra experienced one of its more extreme autumn storms. Indeed, had the politicians who selected the Canberra location in 1908 been exposed back then to the conditions that prevailed in early March 1913, they would surely have looked for a site elsewhere. It was pelting down. The day before the much-anticipated public occasion, the lead journalist in the local newspaper, the Queanbeyan Age, nervously reported on the unabated fury of the weather and its destructive impact on the temporary structures for accommodation and general amenity. The persistent screaming of the wind, the creaking of tent poles and straining of ropes, it was bitterly cold, and men and horses suffered severely. The field hospital was flooded. It was so cold and miserable, that the men of the 28th Light Horse were unanimous in wanting to call the new city Antarctica because of the sheer severity of the wind, with a force, one of them commented, amounting almost to a blizzard. The officers' mess tent, to the amusement of the lower ranks, was blown to ribbons. While Canberra's Commonwealth officials were worried stiff, Victoria's newspapers predictably revelled in the prospect of a looming country New South Wales public relations disaster, holding firm to the notion that Melbourne should remain Australia's capital city forever. But they were destined to be disappointed. On the morning of Canberra's first ever significant national ceremonies, the sun rose brightly on the green-tinged Monaro Plains. Locals, departmental staff, VIPs, everyone involved beamed with delight. A relieved Queanbeyan Age reporter noted that Wednesday was beautifully fine and even warm towards the finish of the affair. Thus it becomes a matter, he wrote, for special congratulation, I assume congratulation to God, that such auspicious weather was enjoyed for this day of paramount importance. Melbourne's Age newspaper grudgingly observed that luck, as usual, has been kind to the Labor Party, while the Sydney Morning Herald was inclined to credit the pleasing change to the presence of the Governor-General and his statuesque wife, Lady Denman. The Minister for Home Affairs, the larger-than-life King O'Malley, was never in doubt, firm in the belief that, as it was reported in the Argus newspaper, the fates had always been kind to him. For the team of government departmental staff, the big day began early. According to the formal program, after a 6:45 a.m. breakfast, the VIPs housed in Queanbeyan began to make their way to Kurrajong Hill to hear at 8:20 a.m. for an 11:30 a.m. start, hours later. Some 400 to 500 official guests had travelled on the Tuesday from Melbourne's Spencer Street Station and Sydney Central, and all had to be transported to the ceremonial site. Trying to leave nothing to chance, departmental officials asked that the general public, mostly residents of nearby Queanbeyan and Bungendore and Goulburn and Yass, attempt to, as they put it, avoid the main road as far as practicable. The locals, however, were never going to have any part of that sort of bureaucratic, we might call it today, risk management rubbish. The report of the Queanbeyan Age, under the heading The Great Trek, confirms that this was one request that was totally ignored. As the journalist playfully recorded, long lines of automobiles filed out of the town. Fine four-horse drags swung along in the wake of the motors, passing in clouds of red dust of less imposing equipages. There were old buses, sulkies, buggies, wagonettes, wagons, lorries, cabs, sociables, carts and bicycles. Every conceivable form of vehicle was requisitioned and joined the procession. At the crossroads, the throng was reinforced by farmers' carts and buggies from the surrounding countryside. Scores of horsemen gave a true colonial flavour to the scene, while hundreds more, failing to find means of transport, tramped to the scene. It was a unique picture, the green undulating fields with thousands of sheep quietly feeding, being disturbed from their solitude by the bustle of a great historic occasion. Since most guests, invited and uninvited, made their way to Kurrajong Hill, not more than 100 metres where they took from where we're sitting today, with plenty of time to spare, all were looking for a bit of preliminary entertainment. The arrival by car of the Governor-General's wife, Lady Gertrude Denman, Trude, well ahead of her husband, was just what they were looking for. It was a simpler time. a favourite with most Australians, including members of the governing Labor Party, Lady Trudy was immediately presented with a bountiful bouquet of flowers by a local resident. There are lovely photographs of it. Six-year-old Stella Bronowski, daughter of one of the Commonwealth's senior draftsmen resident in Canberra. And I think the must have been the niece of the first usher of the Black Rod of the Parliament. The crowds loved it. Closer inspection of the car in which she was travelling would probably have revealed her dainty silk parasol and rather large makeup case. Both items, if you're curious, are on show in the exhibition. Students of fashion in the audience might be interested to know that, according to the account of Adelaide's The Register newspaper, Lady Trudy wore a striking dress of green and white and with a black hat trimmed with a white ostrich feather and a beautiful pearl necklace. When Governor-General Lord Thomas Denman arrived, he too immaculately dressed, sporting an imposing hat with feathered plumage, also both of them in the exhibition, he headed immediately to the Foundation Stones area where he reviewed the cadets and the troops, and he was joined by Fisher, by the Minister for Home Affairs O'Malley, and Senator George Pearce. The few scattered citizens living on the limestone plains had never before seen its like. Not only a visit by the Governor-General, his wife, the Prime Minister, and so many VIPs from across the continent, but all sorts of added attractions. The bright and glittering Sir Walter Bartlett and Major Arnold Quilter, aides-de-camp to the Governor-General, were striking in the uniforms of respectively the Coldstream Guards and the Grenadier Guards, the big black hats. The Australian Field Artillery was there, stationed on Camp Hill, the approximate location of Old Parliament House, to fire first a 19-gun salute, and then, after Lady Denman had named the new capital, a 21-gun salute right on cue. The Mounted Rifles took part, along with the 7th, the 9th, the 11th, and the 27th Light Horse. Then there were the dazzling plumes and scarlet sashes of the New South Wales Lancers. In all, over 700 troops participated in the ceremonial parade. And on top of all this pageantry, some of the honorary local boys were involved as well. The Guard of Honour for Lord Denman comprised two Royal Military College Duntroon senior classes, about 70 fresh-faced cadets in their early 20s, known to the locals, including, apparently, we read, the eligible younger women. The heads of the limestone planers were spinning with excitement. They were used to the occasional exercise of the RMC boys under Captain Smith, but nothing like this grand spectacle being acted out in front of them. Now, to digress for a moment, and on the trail of a spot of gossip, for those of you inclined thus. A few of those present in the crowd on the day had reason to be titillated by more than simply the pageantry. You see, it was rumoured that Sir Walter Bartlett, the Coldstream Guard, who was in Australia with his wife, Lady Bartlett, herself the lady-in-waiting to Lady Denman, Sir Walter was involved in a dalliance, an illicit affair, it seems, with the aforesaid Lady Trudy, Lady Denman. The anecdotal evidence for this is strong. Indeed, two members of the family have confirmed it for me. And we do know that shortly after the Australian sojourn, the Denmans would amicably agree to live separate lives for the rest of their life. They would die within 3 weeks of one another, more or less coincidentally, in 1953, 40 years to the year later. Sir Walter, however, was not so fortunate. He and his fellow aide-de-camp, Major Quilter, both of whom fought at Gallipoli, would be dead by 1918. But whereas Arnold Quilter was killed at Krithia on the Gallipoli Peninsula, walking, we read, stick in hand as he led a desperate attack on a fortified Turkish position, Sir Walter died rather less gallantly, as the British military attaché, based in the Iranian capital of Tehran, he died on the 23rd of October 1918, a bare 3 weeks before the armistice, killed in bed by a cuckolded husband. Sir Walter, it appears, was possibly a serial offender. And on that prurient note, back to the main narrative. On the big 12 March day, with both Sir Walter and Major Quilter reported to be looking resplendent in scarlet and tall black bearskins, They were surrounded by what Bill Laurie might today describe as a happy crowd. The Sydney Morning Herald reporter observed, people sat there in the hot sun possessing their souls in patience. But they were visibly delighted when the real action began as scheduled at precisely 11:30 a.m. with the first ceremony in the official program, the laying of the foundation stones of the commencement column. The column, designed to proclaim the new national capital as imperial, national and federal, would never be built. So it is just as well that the natural performer in the Minister for Home Affairs, King O'Malley, made sure he emphasised the theatrical elements of the day. O'Malley presented Lord Denman with a gold trowel, personally inscribed as a keepsake for the occasion, and asked him to lay the first foundation stone. The Queen Bee and Age takes up the story. A man went to the winch and turned the handle. The foundation stone, already half suspended in midair, moved higher into the air, and a man at the stone itself governed its movements. When the stone was in its right position, the man held his hand up. Then he brought over some cement to Lord Denman. The Governor General of Australia took up a quantity of cement with his gold trowel, and there was a metallic ring as the trowel touched the granite. He was laying it with the gold trowel and cement, and turning to the Prime Minister and the people, His Excellency said, I declare this first stone well and truly laid. Loud cheering followed. Shortly after, Prime Minister Fisher followed suit with his personally inscribed golden trowel, declaring his stone well and truly laid. Amid cheers, and it was reported in one newspaper, a shout of, good boy, Andy. With typical showmanship, O'Malley just had to be different. So his stone, we read, was laid truly and permanently. Onlookers could hardly fail to have noticed the stark contrast of accents featured, which I certainly cannot do. Denman, born to privilege, with his refined English accent. Fisher, down in the grim Scottish coal mines as a boy and still audibly connecting to his Northern Hemisphere roots. And O'Malley, unashamedly Midwestern American, even though he had to maintain the farce that he was born in Canada in order to stand for election in a British Empire country. I should note that, for the first time since the 12th of March 1913, two of these working trowels, those of Fisher and O'Malley, are on show in the exhibition. I hope to have Lord Denman's trowel soon to reunite the glittering triumvirate, and it will depend on the ivory laws because the handles of each have a very small amount, about yay much, of ivory. With any luck, that will arrive before the end of the exhibition. Generally believed in Australia to have been lost for decades, recent research by myself and Barbara Coe, who I think is in the audience today, she and Bruce, led to confirmation of the whereabouts of both the Denman and Fisher trowels. Fisher's is part of the private collection of Sydney businessman, he was in the news recently, Trevor Kennedy, while the extended Denman family in England have made sure that Thomas's golden trowel has stayed safely in its keeping throughout the last century. O'Malley's trowel became part of the collection of the National Library of Australia in 1934 when the NLA's first librarian, Kenneth Binns, asked O'Malley to donate it to the Commonwealth. O'Malley was pleased to do so, as he told in the letter, Brother Binns. Despite vocal crowd interest in the laying of the new city's first three foundation stones, it is certain that the vast majority had come for one reason and one reason only. They wanted to be among the first to hear the chosen name of the nation's fledgling capital. So with the stones well and truly laid, the Governor-General and Lady Denman, along with the Prime Minister, adjourned to a spot at the bottom of the temporary stand and, accompanied, we are told, by massed bands, led a rousing rendition of All People That on Earth Do Dwell, Psalm 100, often referred to as the Old Hundredth. Then all three, with Minister O'Malley, moved to a temporary platform on top of the stones. The Adelaide Advertiser reporter present spoke for the multitude, entitling his splendid coverage of the day's second ceremony, The Secret at Last. When Lady Denman stepped to the centre of the column, which had been converted into a crimson-coloured platform, there was an almost breathless silence. Local residents grouped at the corner of the stand shifted nervously since the whispered information that they were to be singularly honoured had been almost too good to be true. Lady Denman carried in her hand a small golden casket, between the covers of which was hidden a card bearing the mystic word, that would be known all over the empire a couple of hours later. A fanfare of trumpets sounded by buglers announced that the psychological moment had arrived. As the echoes of the last notes died away in the little valleys between the hills, Lady Denman looked around upon the circle of waiting spectators and smiled. "I name the capital city of Australia Canberra." Not Canberra, but Canberra, she said. There was a frantic outburst of cheering from a group of local residents who all along desired to have the original appellation retained. The infection was carried even into, we read, the ranks. Everybody cheered. Another salute of 21 guns was fired. Cheers were given for all who took part in the proceedings, for the King and for the Commonwealth. Well, Lady Denman's announcement finally put to rest months of speculation as Australians across the country sent in a flood of suggestions, some serious, some not, for the political leaders and departmental staff to consider. There was no competition, unlike, of course, to design the capital. But this didn't stop some 800 Australians and overseas aspirants from submitting their preferences. The choice of a name for the new city was never really going to be easy. Too many people were interested in the outcome. The response of the Age newspaper typified the carping Melbourne press in suggesting on the day of Canberra's big event that the people have been contumeliously ignored in the matter of choosing a name. But this was simply not true. Commonwealth records indicate that all the suggestions sent in by members of the public were carefully logged by departmental staff, as you'll see in the exhibition, as were the results of a poll of federal parliamentarians, as you'll also see in the exhibition. We know that the final choice was enormously popular with the many locals present and generally popular across the country. A thankfully prosaic name, according to the Launceston Examiner. Certainly an improvement, the person wrote, an improvement on many of the freak names which were suggested. And let me tell you, there were plenty of freak names. These included a broad mix of suggestions, some creative, some tongue-in-cheek, some brain-dead. Among them, those citizens, for example, keen on local fauna and birds, who favoured names such as Kanga Emu, Kui Umu, Blue Duck, Kookaburra, inevitably, of course, with a C, not a K, and Marsupiala. Then there were those who were keen to express their cynicism about politics, they're always about, who opted for Bungtown, Bunkum, Pawnbroker, Thirstyville, Cackleton, and Gone Broke. Then there were those who were seriously deficient in either imagination or the imperatives of nomenclature, especially Commonwealth nomenclature, who favoured the likes of Wheat Wool Gold and Sid Millad per Brizzo. The utopians chipped in with perfection, with climax. I suspect it doesn't have the further meaning it has today. New Atlantis, Paradisia, and Avalon. Then, of course, there was a representative, racist come humorist, who went for too muchy white fella, city down long and long glow, big one waterhole. Such extreme names, freak names, according to the Launceston Examiner, rubbed shoulders with a small group of genuine contenders. Among them, Acacia, Eureka, Federata, Federalia, and Eucalypta. Minister O'Malley's choice, interesting for an American, was Shakespeare. The Prime Minister favoured the Aboriginal word from Queensland, Myola, until someone pointed out to him that his choice came perilously close to an anagram of O'Malley, with whom he had a professional rather than a close relationship. Myola, the early favourite, was summarily out. It does look as though the final decision on the name was made by an inner circle of governing Labor leaders who finally plumped for the local name Canberra, a decision, as it turned out, that caused immediate frustration concerning, for the politicians, both the meaning of the name and its pronunciation. Was Canberra derived from Canberra in England? Did it come from an Aboriginal word meaning meeting place? Did it come from an Aboriginal word meaning a woman's breasts, thinking of Black Mountain and Mount Ainslie? No one knew for sure. None of the locals did. And then there was the matter of the word's pronunciation. Three syllables, Canberra, or two, Canberra. The final government decision a triumph of pure political pragmatism was whatever pronunciation Lady Denman used on the day, that would be it. And perhaps because of her English origins, she opted for Coimbra. And so it was. Like her male counterparts, Lady Denman had an ideal souvenir of the day. The gold case, the gold casket as it was called, that she opened to reveal the city's name. Personally inscribed like the trowels, but also with an engraving of the Denman crest, the object has remained in the Denman family since 1913 and, I am delighted to say, is on show in the exhibition for the first time in 100 years. It doubles, as you will see, or have seen, as a most serviceable cigarette case and was put to constant use by chain smoker Trudy for the rest of her life. The third and last formal ceremony of a busy program involved a luncheon, the official banquet for some 450 guests in a marquee situated not far from the foundation stones, not far from here. While the menu and toasts might arouse some curiosity today amid a television food show epidemic, it is the substance of the main speeches and toasts by Fisher, Lord Denman, O'Malley and the Attorney General Billy Hughes, destined to be Prime Minister shortly, that reward more intense scrutiny. All four speeches are reproduced in the volume King O'Malley commissioned in 1913 that I mentioned at the outset. Fisher produced his usual solid effort, anticipating the coming capital as a home, as I mentioned at the beginning, for higher learning, politics and art. But it was the Governor-General who soared with by far the best speech of the entire occasion. A really eloquent peroration, according to the Sydney Morning Herald, the best speech he has delivered since he came to Australia. The speech included some jokes about the suggested names of the capital, as the Governor-General wrestled with the pronunciation of the unlikely Sid Millad Perbrizo. We actually hear that too. He was asked to go into the studio in England in 1927 to do the speech, and he did. And O'Malley was asked to do his speech in 1937, I think it was, and he went into the ABC studio. So we have two out of them. There was also, from Denman, a compelling transition into the subject of what he called the creation of a national Australian spirit. And finally, a visionary conclusion, which no doubt had an impact on everyone present. As he said, the city that is to be should have a splendid destiny before it. But the making of that destiny lies in your hands, the hands of your children and those who come after them. Remember that the traditions of this city will be the traditions of Australia. Let us hope that they will be the traditions of freedom, of peace, of honour and of prosperity. That here will be reflected all that is finest and noblest in the national life of the country. That here a city may arise where those responsible for the government of this country in the future may seek and find inspiration in its noble buildings, its broad avenues, its shaded parks and sheltered gardens. A city bearing, perhaps, some resemblance, as I said at the outset, to the city beautiful of our dreams. Now, this was no easy act to follow, although O'Malley and Hughes acquitted themselves pretty well. O'Malley produced a speech that the Argus newspaper labelled, unfairly probably, grandiloquent, and the Sydney Morning Herald suggested it could only be called O'Mallian. Billy Hughes put his mischievous sense of humour to good use, interspersing personal anecdote with sharper commentary. However, when he stated that the limestone plains were, in his words, an ideal spot for a capital in every way, it was clear to his audience that this tough-minded, mightily tough-minded, uncompromising Sydney unionist had become a true Canberra convert. While Hughes was neither temperamentally attuned, nor indeed destined to play a leading role in the national capital's big picture, he is well worth reading on the finer grain detail. Several decades after the Battle of the Sites to find a region to host the capital, Hughes lyrically captured the essence of earlier, perhaps more generous times in the autobiographical volumes he penned in his 80s as he finally sat down to reflect on a turbulent life. A sentence from his Policies and Potentates of 1950 captures the spirit of the enterprise. The story of how the Parliament of the Commonwealth came to choose Canberra as the seat of government is a chapter of history about which lingers the fragrance of romance. And there is certainly a fragrance of a romance attached to some of the key players on the 12th of March. Take, for instance, the legendary King O'Malley. Formerly a slightly tainted insurance agent, real estate agent and banker in the United States in his younger years, O'Malley in Australia reinvented himself as a colonial politician in South Australia, Commonwealth politician, compelling orator, tall tale teller, finance guru and, it seems, charmer of the gentler sex. He defies easy description. He was a genuine one-off. At the age of perhaps 30, in 1888, he came to Australia to stay, returning only once briefly to the country of his birth and dying in Melbourne just before Christmas 1953, the same year as the Denmans, leaving a healthy estate. He was accorded a state funeral as the last survivor, Hughes being the second last, the last survivor of the Commonwealth of Australia's first National Parliament of May 1901, which included a galaxy of future prime ministerial stars: Edmund Barton, Deakin, Chris Watson, George Reid, Andrew Fisher, Joseph Cook and Billy Hughes. O'Malley may have been 95 when he died, but we'll never know because he had to claim in Australia he had been born in the British Empire country in order to stand. He told a lie, a beautiful lie, to use Mark Twain's apt phrase, a lie that everyone in Australia was in on, it seems, for all knew that King O'Malley had been born in the United States. It was O'Malley's good fortune to be popular with enough members of the Labor caucus to see him appointed as Minister for Home Affairs in that Fisher second government from 1910 to 1913, the key years in some ways, despite Fisher's dislike dislike of O'Malley's brash American ways. The Home Affairs portfolio meant that he, O'Malley, had responsibility for the National Capital's foundation years, and he certainly made a distinctive mark. Those he liked were routinely greeted as brothers, Brother Binns, for example. Those he disapproved of were roosters, often guilt-spurred roosters. On the 12th of March 1913, O'Malley was in his element on the big stage. It is difficult to judge who depicted the extroverted O'Malley best that fine autumn day. The official photographer, Claude Vorton, in his genuinely iconic images, many of them in the exhibition, or the Queanbeyan Age journalist who wrote that O'Malley stood side by side of the stone which he was to lay, planted his right foot on it, folded his arms and surveyed the beautiful sweep of country in front of him. Mr. King O'Malley stood there like a king, monarch of all he surveyed. And what about the English visitors on the same podium, the Denmans, Tom and Trudy? Well, we know that Australia's fourth Governor-General, Lord Dudley, was a very poor fit for the job. A man who expected to be treated with deferential regard and to have the whims of his toffee lifestyle encouraged and funded by the locals. Federation Australians deplored his pomposity, his spendthrift habits and his carousing ways. The Australian press responded on occasion with venom, despite the aura of the vice-regal office. John Norton's Truth, read sort of a worse telegraph, John Norton's Truth newspaper excited its readers with a scurrilous reference to Dudley's, quote, concupiscent capers, libidinous lecheries and lascivious lapses. In stark contrast, the fifth Governor-General, Thomas Denman, the third Baron Denman, was a much more comfortable fit for the new job. Both he and his immensely talented, strong-willed partner shared an enthusiasm for the Antipodean challenge, both wanting, as Gertrude wrote sometime later, to work hard. They understood Australia, and the locals responded with great goodwill. The Denmans were legitimately popular. Tom Denman was widely praised in Australia as one of our own, a true man of action. Coming through in the same Sandhurst class as Winston Churchill, he served with distinction in the Boer War, was wounded, and on returning to England, he entered politics as a young and progressive Liberal peer in the House of Lords. A keen sportsman in sport-mad post-colonial Australia, Denman played a handy game of billiards and golf, a good game of tennis, and he could definitely ride with the best of them, making a name for himself in England as a steeplechaser, particularly a military steeplechaser. With less opportunity because of the constraints placed on women at the time, Trudy Denman carved out a truly remarkable life. She refused to be merely a decoration of her husband. In 1912, when fishing off Sorrento in Victoria, she hooked a shark 5 feet long. When it was hauled on board, still very much alive and thrashing, Lady Denman calmly shot the monster, according to Society magazine, with her own revolver, one bullet doing the trick. Encouraged by her parents, Gertrude Pearson, Lady Denman was a free spirit, a keen golfer, tennis and hockey player, and lover of the outdoors. She was one of the first women to obtain a driver's licence in Great Britain. She almost single-handedly organised, not so popular these days, perhaps politically incorrect, but for tens of millions of cigarettes to be sent to the English soldiers in the trenches in France in the Great War. She was in charge, because of her efforts between the wars, she was in charge of the very important position of president, I believe that's what she was called, of the Women's Land Army in World War II. She once dug, with her own spade, own hands, a great big hole herself in the lawns, they must have been really pleased, of Government House, Melbourne, to practice her bunker shots. And she loved the theatre passionately, becoming good friends with our own grand dame, Nellie Melba. I wonder, was it Melba's sense of humour that Trudy especially enjoyed? The Australian diva's well-documented, rather risque ways. On one occasion on ship between the hemispheres, Melba was served a rapidly melting jelly, prompting her to remark to the waiter, "There are two things I like stiff, my man, and jelly is one of them." Perhaps it was a taste for the wicked that forged a bond between independent Nellie and independent Trudy. Tom Denman had a peerage, but little money. So the Pearson fortune of Gertrude's father, Lord Cowdrey, and it was a serious fortune, certainly assisted his career path. While the Denmans did bring to Australia their personal servants, 2 carriages and 3 motorcars, commensurate with their social position, they also brought a no-frills attitude. Both hated excessive formality. I don't have time to document it, but it's very interesting with Thomas Denman particularly. And this was quickly noted and admired by their hosts. So tangible was this chemistry between the Denmans and the Labor men that, as I was told earlier this week by Thomas Denman's grandson, he was here in the building, Mark Burrell, Lord Thomas Denman, D as the family always affectionately called him, took it upon himself to write to the King suggesting that the Australian government should take charge of its should be in charge of its own navy. And this in 1913, as tension between Britain and Germany was rapidly escalating. The suggestion in the letter was never likely to be acted upon. Indeed, Lord Thomas Denman, it was felt by his aristocratic and political peers, had, to use Mark Burrell's phrase just the other day, as believed he'd gone native, crossed over. He had committed the cardinal sin of choosing the periphery Australia over the metropolis England, the colonies over the empire. He was shunned. Hindsight, fortunately, enables Australians to elevate him to the ranks of our most progressive early Governors General. This close Denman's Labor relationship is visibly on show on the 12th of March 1913, as we can see in Claude Vorton's fine photographs, and in particular in the precious Raymond Longford Ernest Higgins film footage of the day's events. This classic 19 minutes of footage has its own distinctive story, its own set of small yet significant miracles. When the private company Spencer's Pictures decided to cover, quite late, Canberra's 12 March ceremony, it just so happened that the most significant person on their books, actor and director Raymond Longford, in time acknowledged as the most important filmmaker in the history of Australian silent film, Longford happened to be between pictures. Spencer sent him down to direct their film together with Ernest Higgins, a highly talented cinematographer, possibly the best in Australia at that time. Longford is best known today as the director of the one acknowledged classic of the 30-year Australian silent film era, and I'm talking about The Sentimental Bloke of 1919, based on C.J. Dennis's popular literary work. The female star of The Bloke was Lottie Lyle. Longford's professional and life partner. She would die very young of TB, I think age 25. As film biographer William Drew has written, in their films, rich with humour and insightful observation, Longford and Lyle revealed to the world for the first time on screen the plucky, resourceful, democratic character of the Australian. Longford and Lyle belong not only to Australian, but also to world cinema. Raymond Longford comes to Canberra for the 12th of March 1913 festivities. His film, all of it, survives. You could not have script written it any better than that. Finally, a few moments on one of the lost narratives of the day, 100 years ago almost. Numerous letters included in the bulging National Archives of Australia file, and the exhibition gives you some idea of that, throw light on individuals from many walks of life, former prime ministers, significant surveyors, journalists, members of parliament, departmental heads and staff, union officials, and prominent Monero residents, to name a few, who failed to make Minister O'Malley's invite list in the first round. The reasons appear to have ranged from bias to oversight to, as I said at the outset, just plain human and departmental ignorance. Other no-shows included invited individuals absent for reasons ranging from severe illness to necessary formal duties. The most notable absence was, of course, the Griffins from Chicago, whose entry number 29 had only 9 months earlier won the international competition to design the federal capital city of the Commonwealth of Australia. The exhibition deals with the complex story of why this happened. You might keep your eye out also for a 6 booklet in the history series Centenary is doing, which will be launched almost certainly by the Chief Minister in the next couple of months to go with the previous 5. I know Greg Wood's in the audience who did 2 of those, and Ian Warden did 1, and I did a couple. But keep your eye out for that. And also I should plug Meanjin, the Meanjin Journal out of Melbourne, which is doing a special Canberra issue in March, where I take up the Griffin story in more detail, both at in the early Australian years and indeed in the Indian years. 3 former prime ministers who had a hand in the early national capital story were also unable to attend. Australia's first prime minister, Edmund Barton, couldn't be there due to High Court duties as acting Chief Justice, though he was there in spirit. The Sydney Morning Herald report mentions the finely worded letter sent by Barton and read out on the day by Lord Denman, being loudly cheered by the crowd. Sadly, Australia's second Prime Minister, Alfred Deakin, and what a story is there, missed the event due to the remorseless onset of dementia, which, as early as 1910, and in his own diary words, crippled his memory and public speeches. And that's 1910, which was the last year that he was Prime Minister for the third time. And in his own diary words, crippled his memory and speeches, making certain that his last decade of life, until his death in 1919, was, in his word, a chaos, as he sat among the ruins or picked his way carefully across the debris to the haven of complete forgetfulness. Extraordinarily sad. George Read, Australia's 4th Prime Minister and a key Canberra supporter in late 1908, when it counted, very shrewd indeed, had to miss the ceremonial day because he was busy with official duties elsewhere as the very first, High Commissioner to Great Britain. In this capacity, Reid had his own important symbolic event to worry about when the King laid the foundation stone for Australia House in London on the 24th of July 1913, a couple of months after here. But perhaps the most heart-wrenching of all the stories relating to the event absentees was that of Arthur Lloyd, picked up in the exhibition. Chief Surveyor of the New South Wales Public Works Department in 1906, when all New South Wales site options were on the table for consideration, Lloyd was personally responsible for a superb map, a very large map, on display in the exhibition. Signed on the 28th of March 1906, the map records 14 sites that he surveyed, making it clear that he favoured sites J and K, sites coinciding almost exactly with today's Belconnen and Central Canberra, which is picked up. I mentioned Greg Woods, one of the 2 books that he contributed to the series, picks that story up really nicely. Overlooked in the first round of invites, poor old Lloyd endured the ignominy of having to request an invitation to the 12 March event. And sadly, it is by no means clear whether the man a journalist once described as the Duke of Canberra was actually present on the day. To conclude, Our national capital has a rich and compelling foundation story, at once local, regional, national and international. It was Australia's unique good fortune that at a key moment in the evolution of global discussion and enlightened planning about cities, that we went in search of a new city to be built from the ground up. The founders a century ago, human, like all of us, flawed, but aspirational, determined, unwilling to shy away from the big questions and the big issues, methodically worked their way through the capital city discussion for well over a decade in the first years of Federation, inspired and refreshed by City Beautiful and Garden City considerations. The events of 12 March 1913 provide us with real insight into personalities and political issues. It was a day of high significance. Australians should know more about their national capital. Let's hope that by the end of this special centenary year, jam-packed as it is with arts, culture, history and heritage, and sport and plenty more, that we will have set about embracing the challenge. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, David, and it won't be due to lack of effort on your part if we fail to appreciate the wonderful story that stories, plural, that lie behind the foundation and development of Canberra. Now, there is a tiny bit of time for one or two questions, should anyone have a question after that marvellous presentation. If you do, can I ask you please to go to one of the microphones at the side on the staircases, and that means that everybody else will be able to hear your question as well. Looks like we might have a couple, so we'll start with, yes, go ahead.
Thank you, David. That was a wonderful talk. Can you tell us a bit about where the foundation stones were originally laid and were they moved and the circumstances of that?
Yes, indeed. We know where they are now, and that's from 1988, when in fact there was a woman who was a special guest at the ceremony, I only learned a few weeks ago, called Mary Canberra Murray, who is no longer with us. But there was quite a celebration that day, as we know, when the three of the six additional stones were laid, you know, Hawke and the Minister and the Governor-General. So we have that spot from the 9th of May 1988. If you are walking from the foundation stones straight back towards the Parliament House, on the left-hand side of Michael Giacomara Nelson's mosaic and water feature, when you've just got to the mosaic, look down, and it was quite by accident, I didn't know, but look down and you'll see a plaque about that big, which is basically where it was, keeping in mind that for 1988, or through the 80s, the top of Currajong Capitol Hill was levelled out a bit more for obvious reasons. So that's where you see the plaque of the original. They went into disrepair. I could have talked about it, but it does look as though King O'Malley's stone was pinched. And that it was replaced, but the others were not. They are originals. But we'll talk a little bit more about that over the next few months. But that's where they were from 1913 through to 1988.
Okay. Yes, sir.
I noticed that in Queanbeyan there's a statue of a chap named Gale, and John Gale, I think, and he's described there as the father of Canberra. I've never heard that description being used within Canberra itself. What's the story there?
John Gale's got a great story. He was the individual who worked so hard as a journalist and community leader in Queanbeyan certainly in the 1890s when he started to crank it up. And in fact, as I think Ian Warden in the Canberra Times has written about a bit, we've talked about it quite a lot, in 1906, Chris Watson, the first Labor Prime Minister for a few months, and a key person with Reid, quite possibly he and Reid were the two key advocates at the key time for Canberra. Watson came here and Gale took him trout fishing to Uriarra. Greg Wood mentioned before, Greg gave the Butters oration, four years ago, where he talked about the fact that not the least of the characteristics that a future capital had to show was that white men could catch trout in the local rivers. It was used a great deal The whole idea of sport, indeed the pitch from Queanbeyan, was on the basis of sporting, shooting, fishing, etc., etc. Gale took Watson there. Watson was already basically, you know, pretty much on message, but that did become important. So he was important as an advocate. And it would be fair to say that of the communities in New South Wales who were the most progressive in pushing the argument along, the Queanbeyan people, especially John Gale, especially in the pages of his various newspapers that he edited, was a very much a key player. And maybe, I mean, Greg's getting a real run in this lecture, but, at least my comments, but in the other book that he did, he talked about the dispossession story of whites, not the black dispossession story, but the white dispossession story. That is to say, it dawned on some of the property owners quite late that they were actually going to get a small amount of money for their properties and, you know, went into a bit of a panic. So that it becomes a more complex story the closer you get to that land being taken back by the Commonwealth. But Gale is extremely important in the general story, and there are a couple of quite good histories of Queanbeyan which recognise that.
Probably our last question on this side.
Jeremy Lassick. Dave, thanks for a great exhibition and a terrific talk today, and I'll never look at jelly the same way again. of things.
Freeze it is my...
The Longford footage, I understand the Film and Sound Archive's done some amazing work on, and we'll all get to see that between now and the 12th of March, I understand. Mm. O'Malley, in the exhibition, he looks a little dishevelled. I would have thought he'd... he'd really look his sprightly best on that occasion, but not so.
Absolutely, mate. I think I've discussed in did on one of the 7:30 report pieces, O'Malley was generally speaking a dapper dresser, and in fact, in the exhibition is a replica of his tie pin from Peter Barclay, who owns King O'Malley's. Peter had that done, but it happened. And I actually haven't looked for the reference. I do believe 2 or 3 years ago in something, I read that O'Malley managed to forget his suit and therefore had to go with the sort of C-grade or D-grade team. And that was the rather slightly dishevelled, as you said, Jeremy, slightly dishevelled suit that he wore on the day. In terms of the film and the Film and Sound Archive, absolutely delighted to say that the Film and Sound Archive has recognised the ultra significance of that 19 minutes, and it was good enough, the film that I used in some of my 7:30 report pieces over the last few years, but they have done, we are told, a pristine print. Jeremy, I know you're back up there. 10th, I think it's the 10th, mate, isn't it? On the 10th of March... On various screens around the city and through that week, the big weekend, you will have that running. And I am hopeful that, it will be up, interspersing with my pieces in the exhibition up here. But it's beautiful enough film, it must be said, in the old print. But we really look forward to that refurbished, pristine print that will be shown for the first time around Canberra and presumably around the country on the 10th of March 2013.
Well, sadly, everyone, our time is up. I commend to you all the exhibition that's on display over near the post office, and I commend for your hearty applause a wonderful lecture from David Heaton. Thank you all for coming, and see you next time. Terrific.
Okay.